Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Daniel Sowa, a former mediator in the Bosnian War who participated in the Dayton peace talks and discussed comparisons between the previous use of American military force based on humanitarian grounds and the current threat to bomb Syria because of the regime's use of chemical weapons against its own people. Then we'll get an analysis of who the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad is and how his so-called reforms that deviated from Ba'athist socialism towards neoliberal crony capitalism led to the rebellion that has now metastasized into a brutal civil war. An Iranian-Syrian scholar and political analyst whose uncle was close to the regime, Dr. Majid Rafizadeh, joins us to discuss how the Western-educated ophthalmologist who threatens to ignite the region unless he rules over Syria continues to argue it is either him or the terrorists. Then we look into the uphill battle the president has to get the House to approve his war resolution, which an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose. MJ Rosenberg, a special correspondent for the Washington Spectator, who worked as a senior House and Senate staffer for 15 years, joins us to discuss the role that AIPAC, the so-called Israel lobby, is playing in rounding up votes for Obama. Then finally, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books, Mark Danner, joins us to discuss recent U.S. interventions and how lessons could be applied to the Syrian situation as we await the U.N. report on the August 21st chemical weapons attack expected at the end of next week, and while a group of Nobel laureates, the elders, call for a referral to the International Criminal Court. And joining us now is Daniel Sowa, who served as the U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton peace talks. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Sowa.
Pleasure to be with you.
And do you see analogies between what happened in Bosnia in terms of a very reluctant president, both his predecessor George H.W. Bush and President Clinton, very reluctant to get involved in the Balkan wars, but eventually did? And do you see an analogy with the current president, who does not seem in any way to be like his predecessor George W. Bush, seems to be much more cautious and seems to be reluctant to get involved, but is now prepared to act on the red line that he's drawn over the use of chemical weapons?
There are some obvious analogies, but I want to emphasize that, you know, the world has changed since the 1990s. The Russia of that period is not the Russia of today. The Syria is not Bosnia. And the Arab world isn't the Arab world, and the United States is different, too. So there may be some analogies, but the context is quite different, I would say, especially after the Iraq and Afghanistan wars.
But the extent to which the Dayton peace accords happened, apparently, because of the bombing, in other words, you had to bomb Milosevic to get him to the peace tables, does that hold in this analogy with Syria?
Well, we don't know whether it holds or not, but what we know is that bombing itself is not a solution, and that bombing, if it's undertaken, should be undertaken within the context of a broader political strategy. What President Obama is saying is he wants a quick, sharp military intervention with no follow-up. And I just don't think that that's a formula that works, and I don't think it's a formula that can be held to either.
Well, isn't the problem here the dictator himself and the dictatorship? I mean, this is somebody...
There's no question in my mind, but that is the problem. It's Bashar al-Assad's refusal to leave power that is at the root of the problem, and a quick, sharp bombing isn't going to affect that at all. And the president is saying he understands that, but he will stop at that. I'm not so convinced that we can stop at that. What if Bashar al-Assad escalates the chemical attacks or conventional attacks, for that matter? What if something we do causes the collapse of the regime and there's a chaotic situation in Syria that threatens law and order in the neighbors as well, even the state structure of the neighbors, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, Turkey? The consequences of military intervention are extremely difficult to predict, and you have to be prepared not only to intervene but to follow up that intervention depending on what happens as a consequence.
Well, is this to say then that regime decapitation, it would be the only strategy? Because one of the lessons from Iraq is clear that the neoconservatives that brought us that disaster, one of the most boneheaded things they did was to demobilize the Iraqi army. And that meant instead of having 400,000 soldiers who could have kept the peace, stopped the looting and maintained order, you had 400,000 unemployed, armed and angry men who became the insurgency. So if you were able to get rid of the Assads, the dictatorship, the family, this mafia family that's ruled this place for over 40 years, would you be able to keep the military and not repeat the mistake of Iraq?
I think that was possible a year ago. I'm less convinced now. I'm less convinced because the Syrian opposition, which at one time was saying that they wanted to preserve the army and the state structures, is now so resentful of what has happened that they're much more inclined to destroy it. I'm afraid that we face in the whatever happens, that we will eventually face a state collapse in Syria that may be very chaotic and very threatening to the region. And that could happen even if we don't intervene. Not intervening doesn't save you from the consequences of the Syrian war.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Serwer, who mediated between Croats and Muslims as a U.S. Special Envoy to the Bosnian Federation in 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreements reached at the Dayton Peace Accords, and he also was the Vice President for Centers of Peacebuilding Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace, and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. He also blogs at peacefair.net. I find what is extraordinary here, Daniel Serwer, is the role of Saudi Arabia and, to a lesser extent, Qatar in bringing in the jihadis, which, of course, serves the ends of the Assad dictatorship. One of the ways that they are able to justify their dictatorial rule to the Syrian people and the minorities who feel that they're being protected by this regime, like the Christians, is essentially that, you know, without me, you'd have Islamic terrorists and Al-Qaeda running the country. And it obviously resonates, and it's not entirely untrue. Why do we allow the Saudis to continually stab us in the back? They created the Taliban. They created Al-Qaeda. They've radicalized Pakistan. And now they've put in these al-Nusra people who really... And my understanding is that the Assad military doesn't really go after al-Nusra. They beat up in the Free Syrian Army because they want these guys in there as a way to justify their dictatorship.
I don't see al-Nusra as a direct product of Saudi policy. I see al-Nusra as fed by a jihadi movement that is strong many places, including in Saudi Arabia, and fed very largely, so far as I can tell, by private money rather than public money. You know, I think we probably talk to the Saudis more about the jihadis and terrorists than about anything else these days. I think they have a very difficult time as a state getting hold of this thing and preventing it from metastasizing. In Iraq, we faced a really dramatic rebellion on the part of Sunni terrorists, and they have united now also with Syrian Sunni terrorists in Syria, and we're facing a regional problem.
And that, of course, is the problem that Vladimir Putin continually points out to Barack Obama, which apparently he did fairly successfully at the G20 meeting in St. Petersburg, where most of the participants sided with Russia, or at least ended up on the side of non-intervention as opposed to joining President Obama and the French.
Well, the problem you've got is that what Putin is doing, which is supporting Bashar al-Assad, is making the problem worse and not better. And I have every reason to believe that the Sunni extremists will eventually make life very unpleasant also for Moscow. I find Putin's position on this question absolutely incomprehensible, since Bashar al-Assad and his excessive reaction to what had been a nonviolent, peaceful rebellion has created a situation that is much worse for Russia than had existed previously.
So what is the rationale then? You understand, is it just that he's, you know, the president referred to him recently as a scowling schoolboy in the corner. Is this personal as opposed to geostrategic?
No, I think it's just strategic in the sense that Moscow is trying to defy the United States, and by defying the United States, enhance its world status, try to regain superpower status. It's a pretty bad way of doing that, but it works very well for Putin in domestic politics, where he's quite popular because of the nationalist, anti-American stance that he takes.
Well, you know, there's a similar stance here in the United States, in the heartland of this country. The Congress people back in their districts are getting yelled at by their constituents. The American people are not aboard intervention. It's pretty clear.
No, it's very clear that the American people are not keen on military intervention at this point. If the president wins in Congress, it'll be because he's won over the Congress, not because he's won over the whole country. He's going to have a very difficult uphill fight winning even in the Congress, especially on the House side.
Well, this is his extraordinary high wire act, isn't it? If he gets voted down, it would be a humiliation and he'd become a lame duck very quickly. And if he squeaks by and gets the vote, he's going to have to perform some kind of miracle here. And we've discussed the only possible outcome. I mean, in fact, you're suggesting there's no good outcome. I was suggesting that maybe with regime decapitation, as they politely refer to it. You know, I keep talking to the Free Syrian Army people, and they keep saying, all you have to do is get rid of the Assads, this mafia family, and Syria will heal itself. I think that's a bit of a pipe dream, but...
I think that's a bit of a pipe dream as well. I'm not saying that there's no good solution. I'm saying that there are a lot of risks in doing something or in not doing anything. There are risks on both sides. I think the right way to point is towards a diplomatic solution, which at the moment we can't get without military intervention. And that diplomatic solution, which has been laid out in an agreement reached more than a year ago with the Russians, would decapitate in the sense of take all power away from Bashar al-Assad and give it to a government formed with the approval of both the opposition and the regime in Damascus. That kind of power-sharing arrangement is very difficult to manage, but it seems to me the right way to go if we want to avoid either a jihadi success in Syria or a success for the regime.
Well, that would involve the need to bring the Iranians into the mix, wouldn't it? I don't see how you could make
that. It absolutely requires bringing the Iranians into the mix, and I don't see much purpose served at this point by trying to keep them out. The Iranians are making loud noises against the use of chemical weapons. Of course, they're blaming the use on the opposition, but they know full well that that's not true. So I think there is some potential for the Iranians getting fed up with Bashar al-Assad.
Well, Daniel Sova, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Sowa, who served as U.S. Special Envoy and Coordinator for the Bosnian Federation, mediating between Croats and Muslims from 1994 to 1996, and he participated in negotiating the first agreement reached at the Dayton Peace Accords. He also was the Vice President for Centers of Peace Building Innovation at the United States Institute for Peace and is now a professor at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, and he also blogs at peacefair.net. And we're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of who the Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad is. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Majid Ravizadeh, who is an Iranian-Syrian scholar, journalist, political analyst, Middle East commentator, and human rights activist. He is president of the International American Middle Eastern and Muslim Council, a senior fellow at Nonviolence International, and a member of the Gulf 2000 Middle East Project at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He previously served as ambassador for Iranian-American affairs and now serves on the board of Harvard's International Review and Harvard's International Relations Council. His latest article at CNN is How Bashar al-Assad Took Syria to the Brink and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Majid Ravizadeh.
Thank you for having me.
And you grew up as a child in Damascus. Is your mother or father Iranian and Syrian?
Right. My mother is Syrian. She's from Damascus, in a neighborhood called Shara Yehud, which means a Jewish neighborhood. And my father is Iranian. He is from a city called Isfahan.
And you obviously know the family, not personally necessarily, but you know people in the regime. And clearly we have an accidental president in Bashar al-Assad.
Right.
His father's favorite, Basil, was a playboy who got killed driving too fast in a Mercedes. And the accidental president, who was training to be an ophthalmologist in London, was told to come back to Damascus by his father and indoctrinated into the Ba'athist, socialist, secular ideals and the use of this incredible military and intelligence machinery that the Assad family maintains its power over this country. I mean, isn't the problem here with Syria the dictatorship itself?
Right. I think you're absolutely correct. The political structure is one of the main problems. And I grew up in Syria, in both in Syria and Iran, and my uncle was close with the Assad family. And I think one of the main problems that I mentioned in my article at CNN that the regime, when Bashar Assad came to power, he really wanted to adopt some sort of Western capitalist and free market structure, but he did not want to give up the dictatorship. He wanted to be the iron fist. He wanted to have control, monopoly over the economy, over the political parties. And I think that was one of the problems that really, you can say, contributed to the revolution. I think the problem is with these regimes like Syria or like even Hosni Mubarak and the other Arab dictators is that they want the benefit of the free market, but they don't want to give up the dictatorship. And one of the risks of marrying authoritarian political structure with the capitalist system would be the uprising that we were witnessing in the last 3 years.
So he, having been spent a lot of time in the West and getting used to Western luxuries, he wanted to modernize the economy and made all those promises.
But essentially what he created was a form of neoliberal crony capitalism, right? I mean, that's essentially...
Exactly. You're absolutely correct. I think he spent... Bashar Assad, he, first of all, he was not really aspired to be a political leader. As you mentioned earlier, his brother, Basil, who was trained in the military, and he was a hardliner, and he was the strong man, charismatic, was supposed to be to succeed his father, Hafez al-Assad, but he died in a car accident. And Bashar al-Assad was not a charismatic leader, and his plan was to be a committed ophthalmologist and to live a luxurious and comfortable life in the West, as the other sons of the Arab dictators do. So when he came back, I think he wanted to implement some of the economic policies that he witnessed in the West. He liked the modernization in the West. He liked the internet, technologies. And so he implemented some of these policies, but it only benefited some of the inner circle of Assad or some of the crony capitalists inside the country. So this really, while some of the people on the top, they accumulated wealth, and they become richer, but the gap between rich and poor increased inside Syria. And numbers shows that there were more people living in poverty before the uprising erupted than really the time that his father was living with a more, you know, socialist, bad political structure.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Majid Rafizadeh, who is an Iranian-Syrian scholar, journalist, political analyst, Middle East commentator, and human rights activist. He's the president of the International American Middle Eastern and Muslim Council, a senior fellow at the Nonviolence International, and a member of the Gulf 2000 Middle East Project at the Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He previously served as ambassador for Iranian-American affairs and now serves on the board of Harvard's International Review and Harvard's International Relations Council. His latest article at CNN is How Bashar al-Assad Took Syria to the Brink and Beyond. So making the rich richer and the poor poorer led, of course, to the uprising, which was in part, first of all, the uprising against Bashar al-Assad's regime started in the poor working class neighborhoods of both Damascus and of the town Daraa on the border, which is, I think, the poorest town in the country. So there's no question that the people rose up in the spirit, if you will, of the Arab Spring. And similarly, you mentioned Mubarak. I think there's a lot of analogies there. But
right.
The cynicism here of this regime is so extraordinary. And the gift that the Saudi Arabians, who want to bring them down, ironically are giving Assad is the al-Nusra Front, which, of course, feeds right into Assad's narrative that it's either me or the terrorists. And he's also got – he's taken it beyond that, I think, and as you implied in your CNN article, he's willing to bring the whole region down if they take him out. And that's pretty much his threat. And it's extraordinary that it's gone on this long. And I've been astounded how Hillary Clinton said he was going to last a few months and, what, he's lasted a couple of years.
Right. I think that's a great point that you bring up. I think Bashar Assad, he was smart from the beginning. He's a shrewd politician. He knew how he saw the uprising in Libya. He saw in Egypt. He saw how they were able people to overthrow the regime. He knew that in order really to sustain his power, he had to divide and rule. And other thing, he had also to turn Syria conflict into a three-dimensional conflict. By that, I mean he had to not only make it domestic conflict, he had to make it regional conflict and also international conflict. The domestic one, he had to turn different rebel groups against each other. He from the beginning, he said there are terrorists, they're fighting with us, so there are the Islamist group coming from outside, and he used the language of terrorists and like what you said, finally his words came through, and the other Islamist group started operating, and they are now the most successful, you can say, organized group inside Syria, fighting with Assad. And again, these rebels are fighting with each other, with the Kurds fighting with the other Sunni Arab. And then he created also the regional tension, which is between Saudi Arabia and you can say Gulf Arab Strait, Arab states, including Qatar on one side, and then we have the Shiite coalition, which is Iran and Hezbollah on the other side. And then there was the international level of the conflict, which we have Russia and China supporting Assad, and then we have primary United States and Western allies on the other side. So what really made this conflict to go on for so long is because it's not only a domestic conflict. It has turned into a three concentric circles of tension that are operating simultaneously. And always it is really difficult to resolve conflicts which have more than one dimension.
Sure. Well, I think that when you conclude in your article that if Assad does not rule over a unified Syria, he can instigate a conflict throughout the region and turn the nation into a conflagration. And that would explain why he upped the ante with the use of chemical weapons, is that he's basically prepared to take the whole house down, because it's the old French expression, l'état c'est moi, I am the state.
Right.
You know, après moi, le déluge, you know.
Right, right. I think you're absolutely correct. But also, I think we should be careful that some of these dictators come up with sometimes with these empty wars, that we were trying to do that, and Saddam Hussein was also like that, or other. But I think Bashar al-Assad has, the international community knows that Bashar al-Assad and his regime and his community has really the capability of turning the region into a conflagration. And he said that. He said if he doesn't, if the war doesn't let him to rule over unified Syria, he can instigate as much as violence as he can through the region. I mean, we should know that the Alawite community are approximately around 15% of the Syrian population. There are around 36,000 high general officers in Syria, in which they are still loyal to the regime. 28,000 of these trained generals are Alawite, and still they have really not defected. And I think he had the capability into turning this Alawite community into a strong proxy like Hezbollah. And I think he is, as you know, Syria has one of the largest stockpile of chemical weapons in the world. So they have all the military and ideological capability really to instigate violence in other countries.
So one of the things that's extraordinary about the US and the West's approach to this all along is that they really don't appear to have only recently discovered the moral argument against the use of chemical weapons. They seem to be satisfied with the idea that both sides were killing each other, the Alawites and the al-Nusra people, neither of whom anybody much likes. And it Right. reminds me of the cynicism of the Iran-Iraq war, where Henry Kissinger said, it's a pity both sides can't lose. So maybe that was our policy. But the fact that that Assad crossed this line and the president's credibility is on the line has led to the current situation, which, again, what they're talking about, you know, the country's clearly against it here in the United States.
Right.
But it is called a war, and I think to that extent, maybe it's an exaggeration. We called Grenada a war, but it was like a training exercise.
Right.
And what they're talking about seems totally futile, you know, dropping a few cruise missiles on the main airport to shut that down so the Iranian supplies don't come in, and they'll fill the potholes in the next day. So none of that makes any sense. The only thing that makes any sense would be what they politely refer to as regime decapitation. If that were to take place, and it could be executed, would the army stay intact and be there to hold the country together?
That's a great question. I think, first, as you mentioned, I think the really limited military strikes is not going to tip the balance of power inside Syria. In fact, it's going to embolden the regime to use more violence, and it's going to embolden the supporters of the regime like Iran and Hezbollah and Russia to provide Syria with more advanced weapons. So it's, I think it's more, you can call it as a more face-saving operation for the United States, because the president has came out last year saying that it's a red line to use chemical weapons, and reports came keeps coming out that they have used chemical weapons. So I think it's a more issue of credibility and to follow up on their own words. But if they want really to tip the balance of power inside Syria, and back to your question, I think it really depends on how can you create a coalition which can which can decide on what kind of the government system of governance will be set up in Syria. I think they have to bring all these groups together, or the leaders of these groups together, and make sure that the army or the police officers inside Syria would also be part of this coalition, because we should know that for more than 40 years, Syria has been run by this military, police, and intelligence institution, and they can't really to wipe out completely these groups and create a new system. They have to incorporate them, and I think in order to do that, we have to bring all these oppositional groups together, and they have to ensure the Alawite general officers that their lives will not be endangered. And I don't think that is possible now, because the division is so deep, really, inside Syria among the oppositional groups. Among different, they have different ideologies, they have different political agendas, and I'm not sure if they can accomplish that now.
Well, Dr. Majid Rafizadeh, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Majid Rafizadeh, who is an Iranian-Syrian scholar, journalist, political analyst, Middle East commentator, and human rights activist. He is president of the International American Middle Eastern and Muslim Council, a senior fellow at the Nonviolence International, and a member of the Gulf 2000 Middle East Project at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs. He previously served as ambassador for Iranian-American Affairs and now serves on the board of Harvard's International Review and Harvard's International Relations Council. His latest article at CNN is How Bashar al-Assad Took Syria to the Brink and Beyond. And we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about the president's uphill battle to get the House to approve his war resolution, which an overwhelming majority of Americans oppose. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who is a special correspondent to The Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to The Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you, Ian.
And there's quite a lot to talk about, MJ. Specifically, I wanted to talk to you about how the president's going to get this vote. There's obviously a disconnect between the Congress and the people, and the Congress people are hearing from their constituents who are extremely upset and quite vocal that they oppose this war. And somehow the president has got to navigate between the Republican House, many of whom just simply hate him and would vote against him to hurt his credibility, which is on the line. My understanding is that the only hope that the president has is AIPAC, the so-called Israel lobby, that are rounding up the votes.
Yeah, I think it is the only hope that that the administration has to win is the pressure that AIPAC can bring on members of Congress, specifically by threatening to, withhold campaign funds if the member of Congress votes the wrong way. I don't think it's going to work. I think that the proposal is going to fail in the House. Many of AIPAC's own supporters in the House, many of them are going to vote no. I noticed that Alan Grayson of Florida, who is, I mean, about as APAC as you can get, is heading up the effort to get a no vote on this. And he said, he had an interesting quote. Grayson was asked about APAC, and again, he's an APAC guy, and he said, APAC is irrelevant when the people speak. That's usually not true, but the fact is the people don't speak that often in as clear a voice as they are right now with members of, running, 90 to 10, 95 to 5 in congressional offices against this. So I think, the fact is members of Congress, I worked there for 20 years. Their main concern, almost virtually their only concern, is getting reelected. If going with AIPAC is not going to help them get reelected, but it's going to hurt their chances of getting reelected, they're not going to go with AIPAC. So I see this as just a disaster for AIPAC as well as for the administration. I can't imagine that the president can turn this around.
And in spite of the fact that the House Majority Leader Eric Cantor and the Democratic Majority Whip Steny Hoyer, both AIPAC partisans, who are cracking the whip?
Well, it's funny. I mean, Hoyer and Cantor are as much AIPAC as if that they were staff of AIPAC. I mean, and yeah, they're leaders, but these days, members of Congress are pretty resistant to their own leadership. We see that on a host of issues. So I don't, I can't see it. We're close to 218, which is the majority, members of the House already saying flat out that they are going to vote no. They're not at 218. They're not there yet. They're just under it. But once they flat out say it, that means Obama, they might as well not schedule a vote because he's going to lose. Unless, of course, his speech, I don't know what day is, Tuesday, I think, Obama's speech is so persuasive that it, kind of the way Ronald Reagan used to be, or, JFK or FDR, that he turns votes around. But I don't think any of them ever turned a vote around that looks so overwhelmingly negative from their point of view.
Well, clearly the president got a heavy lift. Now, you mentioned Grayson. He wrote a piece in the New York Times arguing that he would vote. He's prepared to vote no now, and he was very unsatisfied with the intelligence that was provided. And apparently they're going to try and do a better job providing intelligence. They've also released some videotapes of the people that were gassed. This is all taking time. I mean, there's so much hyperbole involved. First of all, they call this a war. What they're talking about is not a war. It's just some sort of weird symbolic use of cruise missiles. But maybe, right. I've explored the possibility with the two previous guests that what the real agenda is here is regime decapitation. What the consequences of that would be. But you've got the UN vote coming up at the end of the week and the House vote at the end of the week, the Senate political vote earlier. There's plenty of time here to build a case if you get the world on your side, which so far is not happening.
I agree. If the United Nations comes around, there's a vote that's in our favor, and it would no longer be a unilateral or a mostly unilateral U.S. action, and I suppose it's possible that would change. That would certainly change enough Democrats. Obviously, Republicans don't change because of anything the U.N. does or doesn't do. But and as far as evidence why it's hard to believe that they would wait to the last minute before they would present definitive evidence. I mean, the president and the administration understand that once members of Congress announce their position, it's very hard for them to turn back and go the other way. Seems to me if they have really concrete evidence, they would have used it already. One more point I want to make is the thing about the AIPAC involvement. they are really in a, you know, they are supporting this not because, you know, they're, no, I shouldn't say supporting it, they are pushing for this authorization to bomb Syria, not because of Syria, but because they want the United States to be in a position to go to war with Iran over the nuclear issue when the time comes. If they lose that this vote, which means if the president loses this vote, it will make it look, it'll be very unlikely that the United States would be able to go to war. In the case of Iran, it would be go to war, because we're probably talking regional conflagration over Iran. So the stakes are huge in this battle.
Well, it's extraordinary how little reference there is to AIPAC. I believe the New York Times did refer to them trying to whip up the vote for Obama, and then they retract it or delete the reference to AIPAC?
Yeah, the Times had a piece, I think it was last Sunday, it appeared Sunday night, and they had an administration official, unnamed, saying that AIPAC was the 800-pound gorilla, that was the phrase that was used, that would help, you know, put the administration on the winning side of this. And by the next day, that the story was still there, but the whole part about the gorilla and AIPAC's role was gone.
Right, well,
it's just, you know, this is a very typical thing. I notice on MSNBC, which has the nerve to occasionally hint at the existence of the lobby, they will do it without saying AIPAC, or when they say AIPAC, without defining what AIPAC is. I mean, this is the, you know, this is an area that you don't see nearly as much about it as you should, because people are afraid to talk about it.
Right, and in today's in Sunday's New York Times, of course, there's a very big front page article about the history of Syria's chemical arsenal, which is entirely due to Israel's nuclear bomb. They built this massive chemical weapons arsenal as a poor man's deterrent against a nuclear weapon. Never a mention of that. I mean, it's extraordinary the how the 800-pound gorillas disappear.
Yeah, I mean, it is. You know, the most powerful country in the Middle East is Israel. And the way this whole, everything's portrayed in the American media, and to a large extent in the European media as well, is that Israel is like the poor, you know, the poor little David of the David Goliath story, surrounded by all these scary Goliaths that could do anything at any time. Israel has, you know, it said that, you know, around 200 nuclear weapons. The no other country in the Middle East has nuclear, you know, nuclear weapons at all. And obviously, countries around Israel want to have nuclear weapons, and that includes Iran too, which isn't right on the borders, because they want to have it as a form of deterrence, not to use it, more like the way the U.S. and the Soviet Union both wanted nuclear weapons, as you know, to defend against using them. But that's never talked about. Israel right now can do whatever it wants in the Middle East. If it decides to bomb Lebanon tomorrow or Syria, and it did not long ago bomb a kind of a rudimentary Syrian nuclear reactor that was built for the Syrians by the North Koreans, it just does it. And, you know, or when it wants to, you know, bomb Gaza, like it, you know, there have been two wars in the last decade, where Israel, mm-hmm. not really wars, Israeli onslaughts against Gaza killed, you know, a couple of thousand people. Israel does it. Nobody could tell them not to do it. And the United States supports it. And the United States says nothing about the fact that Israel uses chemical weapons in, you know, in Gaza, like we're used, you know, the phosphorus, you know, to provide a smoke cover for its, you know, for troop movements and whatever. I mean, it's a double standard completely, and it's kind of outrageous.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, MJ Rosenberg.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent to the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years. And joining us now is Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, and professor. He was a longtime staff writer for The New Yorker and is a regular contributor to the New York Review of Books. And he teaches at the University of California in Berkeley and at Bard College. His books include Stripping Bare the Body, Politics, Violence, War, The Secret Way to War, The Downing Street Memos, and The Iraq War's Buried History, and Torture and Truth, America's Abu Ghraib and the War on Terror. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Danner.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
And do you see any recent historical examples of U.S. intervention that the U.S. could learn from, either in deciding not the decision will be made by Obama, but might well be made by the House, that we won't intervene? But on the other hand, if we do, is there any learning? I mean, it seems to me that everybody's paralyzed by what Bush, Cheney, and Rice and Rumsfeld did in Iraq. And that really is ruling the attitude of the American people, which in turn obviously is affecting the Congress, who supposedly represent them.
Well, I think it's absolutely true that history is haunting us. There's no question about it. And, you know, it's hard to think, not to think about the run-up to the Iraq War in late 2002, early 2003, when you hear about the claims of the chemical attack, the Congress demanding more information, people telling us that they have the information, but it can't be made public, et cetera. So that looms around us, and it's one of the great ironies that the current president, Barack Obama, was elected in saying his most famous line, which is he isn't against all wars, he's just against dumb wars. And he was talking about Iraq at the time, of course. When you ask about historical parallels, I think it's a complicated question, of course. The one I tend to think of, and I can't believe I'm saying this, but is Bosnia, is the war in the Balkans. The lesson I guess I would draw from that in retrospect, I mean, I covered it at the time, and there was a great genocide going on that probably killed 250,000 people. The U.S. essentially watched from overhead with its F-16s and F-15s. NATO had peacekeepers there but didn't intervene militarily. But finally, in 1995, the Clinton administration did launch a large-scale bombing campaign against the Serbs. And that, along with, and I think this is the critical parallel, along with a Croatian offensive on the ground that kicked the Serbs out of the Krajina, that did eventually lead to a diplomatic solution. And so I guess if one wants to look at recent history, one lesson to draw is that interventions are successful when they're not simply undertaken for humanitarian reasons, but they have a realist component as well that actually will lead plausibly to some ending of hostilities. Now, as I say, I'm surprised to hear myself saying this because at the time, I was outraged, really, increasingly so, covering the war, that the U.S. and the West weren't helping defend Bosnian civilians and were sort of standing by where this massive killing took place. But in retrospect, you can see that the U.S. essentially waited until there was, in essence, a military component and a solution that could be seen on the ground that was absolutely imperfect. That is, it wasn't a just solution by any means, but it did bring peace. It did bring the end of the killing. I think this was about as imperfect an intervention as one could imagine, except for the current one, in which it seems to me when we're talking about Syria, we're talking about a very limited strike that would punish the Syrians and the Bashar al-Assad regime for stepping over a red line, violating a norm that is using chemical weapons. And there appears to be no component part of this idea that would lead to actually ending the conflict. On the contrary, it seems to me plausible that this U.S. intervention might make the conflict worse. So while everything in my bones says, you know, the U.S. should do something when you have a killing of 1,400 people using chemical weapons, I'm quite unpersuaded by the kind of ad hoc nature of what the administration has proposed. It doesn't sound to me like it's very well thought out or that it will go anywhere toward actually ending the killing.
But Mark Danner, perhaps the reason it seems sort of inadequate and symbolic is that they don't want to say what perhaps the real intention would be, which is what I was discussing earlier, which is regime decapitation. And Most of the guests that I've talked to said that that's likely what the strategy will be, to try and get rid of this mafia family and hope that the country can hold together afterwards. But most – the two people I talked about this earlier in the program thought that things were too far gone, which goes back to the U.S.'s feckless response to – the rebellion when it first started, and the overconfidence of people like Hillary Clinton, who thought it would be all over and Assad would fall. Obviously, they miscalculated, and they could have maybe done something then before the Saudis brought their al-Nusra people in, who now have poisoned the well and are playing right into Assad's hands.
Well, those two points are actually quite related, the one about regime decapitation and the surprising length of the war. I mean, I agree with you that there may be ideas within the U.S. national security bureaucracy that a strike might, if precisely targeted, actually have a very large follow-on effect on the regime itself, particularly if you killed members of the Assad family. People may be thinking that, but I'd remind listeners that that's exactly the way the Iraq War began, with an attempt to kill Saddam Hussein at Dora Farms. And, you know, these things are not – regimes like this, it is not very easy to, quote-unquote, decapitate them. The other problem, of course, is it's not simply the Assad family. We have a very large national security bureaucracy there consisting of – you know, the 4th Armored Division, military intelligence, civilian intelligence. It's a very complex, interlocking security regime that vaguely resembles Saddam's regime as well. I mean, they both come from similar ideologies about 4 or 5 decades ago. And I'm unconvinced that simply killing or decapitating the regime at this point would bring an end to the war. It might make it easier, or it might make things much more chaotic. I think it is true that people in the U.S. government, as you said, including Hillary Clinton and others, underestimated how difficult it would be for a rebellion that started in the streets of Daraa in the south actually to take over the country. I mean, in part, this has to do with the particular sectarian makeup of Syria, and the fact that you have a minority regime that itself is supported by other minorities. You know, you have the Alawi, and then you have the Christians as well that back it. You also have the business class, which seems to have stayed fairly strongly, the large business class fairly strongly behind the regime, and the military, which, though there have been a lot of defections, the core of the military, the Alawi officer class, seems to have remained firmly, so far as we can tell, pretty firmly behind the Assad regime. So I guess I'm unconvinced that simply lobbing a few cruise missiles, if you kill the right people, would actually end the war or lead to a diplomatic solution. To me, this doesn't seem like a strategy. It may be what is being thought in the White House and the Pentagon, although I kind of doubt it. I think that they're probably pretty skeptical about that plan of events as well.
And meanwhile, you've got the Obama haters on the right in the Congress who will vote just to spite him because they hate him so much, because his credibility is on the line, and he'll be a lame duck if they vote him down. And then on the left, you've got a lot of people, in spite of the fact that this rebellion started in the working class neighborhoods of Daraa, you just mentioned, and the poor suburbs of Damascus. The left, at least elements of the left, seem to be in this country and abroad, seem to be bending over backwards to make excuses for this dictator. I don't understand that. I don't understand why people, the left used to be the champions of, railing against, quite rightly, U.S. hypocrisy during the Cold War of supporting the Marcoses and the Somozas and the Shah dictatorships. And nowadays they seem to be all in favor of this guy, and they're even suggesting that, I mean, friends of mine like Ray McGovern and Larry Wilkerson are now talking about that maybe this chemical weapons attack was a false flag Israeli operation, or that somehow the U.S. will shoot down or blow up one of its own destroyers to embroil us deeper into this war. I mean, what's going on with that? Why are people going so far into this kind of weird speculation to make excuses for Assad?
Well, I think there's a lot of distrust. I mean, I think the first point that should be made is the case for these strikes is unpopular in the country, so far as we know. The president has not made his case publicly that this is necessary to a public that is very weary, not only of war, but of being lied to. And I think that's a, you know, extremely important point to make, that this is happening under the shadow of 9/11 and of the wars that followed it, particularly Iraq, but also Afghanistan, in which I think the public became very wearied of war and also weary of the feeling that it was being manipulated. So I think there's a lot, there's a lack of trust that's very important on the part of the general public. I think you're quite right about the right wing in Congress. They'll do anything to oppose Barack Obama. But again, to be fair, I don't think the president has made his case very convincingly of what exactly this will be. He's in this odd position of demanding a strike, but also having to emphasize at the same time that this will not be Iraq, this will not be Afghanistan, this will not lead to a wider war. And that argument is not terribly convincing, because he doesn't say what exactly it will lead to in a convincing way. And finally, your point about the left, I think, you know, there is a broad segment of the political culture that we could call the anti-war left, that simply does not want to see another attack and another war, and that's distrustful of what has happened to the United States since 9/11, the vast spending on national security, the expansion of just not just military, but surveillance and other things, the use of torture, the maintenance of Guantanamo, all of these things fit together. And I think that the, what you identify as members of the left that have gone so far as to, in a sense, seem to support the Assad regime or defend it, I think this is, at least my perception is, this is a fairly limited part of the left. Those who are talking about the chemical attack possibly being a false flag operation and so on, I think that reflects to some degree the fact the administration hasn't made publicly its case. It hasn't showed its evidence that proves that this attack did come from the Assad regime. Normally, of course, they might be able to count on, on their own credibility and saying, you know, trust us. But we are in the shadow here, the dense shadow of the run-up to the Iraq war, in which we were told again and again, trust us. And the not only was the evidence faulty, but we were able to disprove it on the ground, which is a very unusual case. So I guess I tend to think, you know, to me, the broader point here is I am somewhat amazed that the Obama administration decided at this, in this kind of ad hoc, rather abrupt way, to go to Congress for approval, because it looks to me, at least from what I have observed, that it's very likely the House will vote this resolution down. It's possible he'll get an approval from the Senate very narrowly, and he'll be voted down in the House. And I'm not sure what that means. You know, you go to the Congress to try to get public backing, as it were, so you're not alone politically if the consequences of this attack lead to something else and the involvement becomes much deeper. And but what does it say if you fail to get approval? I mean, it's kind of an unprecedented situation, I think, and it seems very, very badly thought out, very abrupt, very ad hoc. And I think, by the way, part of the distrust of Obama, particularly in the House and among Republicans, is this notion that he basically doesn't know what he's doing.
Well, I'm afraid that you're ending on a note there that certainly seems to be the what's happening at the moment. And Mark Danner, I'm afraid we've run out of time, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Danner, who's a writer, journalist, and professor, longtime staff writer for The New Yorker, and a regular contributor to The New York Review of Books. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, assistant producer Michael Schertzer. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.